Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 8th of November 2011, and it is a Tuesday, but we are talking to our regular Monday guest, Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster, and let me give my own mea culpa and apologies to everyone, including Mr. Chapman, because it was my own dumb fault for actually forgetting our regular every week appointment last night. So it's my own dumb fault that this is a day late, but at least Bob Chapman is gracious enough to give us another hour of his time on a different day, because there's always so much going on, and it's always a pleasure to have him on. So Bob, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, you're welcome, and I like this early time of the morning because I can watch the sunrise.
Excellent. Well, it's early for you, late for me, but I think that works for both of us both ways. So let's get straight into it, because there is so much going on. And of course, last week we were treated to another G20 spectacle in Cannes, France, with the world so-called leaders gathering to divvy up their portion of the world. Tell us about what you've heard about the G20 conference and what was going on behind the scenes.
Well, I think because they couldn't come to anything solid on the bailout and the leverage thereof, they want to use derivatives to augment the $518 billion that will be contributed, half of which comes from Germany. And they want to use leverage to make that $1.4 trillion. And the federal court in Germany has said, I don't think you can do that. We got to talk about that again. And they also told the Bundestag, which is the House of Representatives, that you couldn't form this committee like the U.S. has of 12 to bypass Congress. And so those things are up in the air. One of the things that did come out of that meeting, which wasn't supposed to come out, was that in the European press brought this out, which surprised me. One of the things that was discussed was that, well, why doesn't Germany put up their gold as collateral on the derivatives that are being created in order to give this extra funding? And the Germans came back, several of them, top people, and said, no, we're not going to do that. Now, the question then arises, when you frame this thing, you got to look at it and say, well, who else in Europe has lots of gold? And two countries that really stick out are purportedly have gold. They lie about everything, so you don't know for sure. France and Spain are loaded with gold, if they haven't leased it all or sold it. And so why don't they put up gold as well? And the reason, obviously, is that France and Italy are broke. Germany is not. So let's let the Germans put it up. And if they get broke, so what? Then we'll all be broke together. This is the thinking. And, of course, the bankers are behind all this because they want to be compensated if everything goes haywire, like it already has. They get all this debt not only from Greece but the other five countries that are in financial trouble. And the seat of power behind the scenes, the Illuminati, the Bilderbergers, etc., is a financial system. And as long as the financial system continues to function the way that it does, to the advantage of the bankers and with the backup of the countries that they control through banking that bails them out all the time, allowing the taxpayers to pay for it, they don't want that system to end. And it's very important that people note that if the system goes down and the bankers and their banks essentially, generally, get destroyed, that's bad for them. It's bad for us because most people throughout the world, and particularly in Western Europe, the United States, England, will lose probably 90% of what they have, like happened in the 1930s. But the give up is they lose their power. The game from behind the scenes is over. And that's really the only way they're going to get taken down. And that's why they're fighting to bring it down without a collapse. Bring about one world government instead of collapse. And of course, this has not gone very well for them. You see what's going on with the Eurozone, etc. So those are some of the things behind the scenes that were talked about. Berlusconi was there. He's the PM from Italy, member of the Illuminati, incidentally. And he said, well, the restaurants in Rome and in Paris and here in Cannes are full of people, so I guess there's no problem. And I think he's going to be out of office shortly, although that in the next several days. Inside sources tell me that, yes, he probably will be out of office by next Monday. But, you know, who are they going to put in his place? You look at Italian politics, and it's truly, excuse me, I have one of those upper respiratory things. And who are they going to put in this place? The communists, maybe? I don't think so. That's not going to work very well. The last time we were in office, 8 or 10 years ago, everything that wasn't nailed down was stolen. And so they left the country in a terrible state. And not that the party in power is any better. Actually, in Italy, the Northern League is probably the sanest of the whole group, and they're not overly controlled by the bankers. And it'll be interesting to see where they end up in all this. They probably, even though they're not a major party, but they're a strong party, maybe somebody from that party would be better. The problem is, it's like in every country, it's not who you want to have in an important position to serve the people. They have no intention of serving the people. All they want to do is serve themselves. They want to become richer and more powerful and subdue more people. And that's done legally under the rules that they get passed. And so for good people to rise to the surface and come PMs of any country or presidents of any country is extraordinarily difficult. And if they don't like him, he gets close, they kill him. Or if he gets in office and he starts talking about things that are near and dear to the heart of the people behind the scenes, then they end up like Jack Kennedy. And so it's pretty difficult under present circumstances to get legal changes and to have those changes make changes within each country. And so that's why you revert back to stopping that system. And the way you do it is allowing the banking system to fail. And I think that's going to happen eventually. But they'll draw it out as long as they can. They were the ones that started this thing. And now they're certainly having second thoughts about it. Because it's out of control. Let's look at Greece. I know we've been looking at it for 2 years, but we know the formula. And that is, and I talked about this extensively on radio and television and in the press in Greeks for the last couple of years. And they go into default. They renege on all their bonds and the loans that they own. And they go to a drachma, make it worth 50% of what the euro is. And over a 5 or more year period, cut back the expenses of government. The man who runs the country at the moment, Mr. Papandreou, is really a communist. And his father Andrus was a communist. And his father Andrus probably stole more money from the Greek people than anybody in history. And incidentally, there's about 50 members of the Illuminati who are in Greece. There's some very, very wealthy people. And none of them pay taxes. It's probably one of the reasons they have the problems they've got. Anyway, they're going to have an interim government. A coalition has been agreed to. And this interim president, or PM, will serve for a maximum of 40 days. I forget. But anyway, it'll be a limited amount of time. And they expected the elections to be on the 19th of February. But that can change. So, who is this man? Who is it going to be? My people over there tell me it's going to be Lucas Papademos. Now, he is going to be put into that position by an agreement between Papandreou, Antonis, Samaras. And those two people lead the opposite parties, Papandreou, Pascos, and the other is called, I think, the Free Democratic Party or something like that. And so they're both responsible for this man being in office. And this is an important point, and you'll see why in a minute. This man is a visiting professor of public policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And he previously was a vice president of this European Central Bank and served as a senior economist at the Federal Reserve in Boston when it was run by a young man who's no longer young. He's 74 years old. He used to be the head of the Fed in Boston. He went to high school with me. And I never expected him to get into a job like that. But he did, and he obviously did quite well. And he's been retired some years now. This man, Lucas Papademos, served as senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston in 1980, joined the Bank of Greece of 85. No, 85 is when Andres Papandreou was in office. He was a chief economist, rising to deputy governor in 1993 and governor in 1994. So he was there while all these mistakes were made. And the knowledge that all of those loans and bonds should have never been issued by the Greek government. So this man is a key part historically in this caper, this criminal enterprise that caused these problems in the first place. But during his time as governor of the National Bank, he was involved in Greece's transition from the drachma to the euro. After leaving the Bank of Greece in 2002, he became VP to Jean-Claude Trichet at the European Central Bank, and he was there for 8 years until last year when he left to serve as an advisor to George Papandreou, the president of Greece at the moment. So what this is it's an inside job. And the very fact that Samaras has agreed to this tells you he's a sellout. And oh, I forgot one thing about Mr. Papademos. He has been a member of the Trilateral Commission since 1998, and he's a member of the Bilderberger Group. Now, can you imagine what these people are going to do to the Greek people? They have every intention of burying that country in debt forever and ever. And I hope that the press, the head of the Greek Orthodox Church is a subscriber, and the people in radio and television really hop all over this. I mean, this guy and Papandreou and Samaras, they have sold out the Greek people. They're going to do what they want to do if this guy gets in place, even though he's only going to be there until February the 19th, which is, what, 3 months. And so this is the kind of thing that you can expect to see in these governments, which are all controlled by the bankers from behind the scenes, just like the United States government. is controlled. And so the polls say in Greece that the public is 71% in favor of staying in the euro, but they don't want to pay any money back. They said they're not responsible for it. And they don't want austerity to the extent that it's been pressed upon them. The Greek people are ambivalent. They want to have their cake and eat it, and they can't. They can't compete in a euro world. They just can't. And they've proven that over and over again. In fact, I have a chart. I think it's in the last 150 or so years. They've defaulted on debt 5 times, but they're not the champion. There's others like Spain, which are even worse. But most people don't know about that. And so the Troika, the IMF, the EU, and the Eurozone have told the Greek people, you know, take it or leave it. You either take the loans we're going to give you, or get out of the euro and default in your history. And that's the way the outlook looks at this very moment.
Well, you raise a lot of points there, but I think I have to hearken back to the points that you made about politicians who try to actually change the system and end up getting their head blown off, like JFK. And I don't know if you had the chance to catch my rather remarkable interview with Daniel Estulin over the weekend, but he, according to one of his sources, I guess there was a conference, a private meeting between Sarkozy and Papandreou, in which Papandreou's, I guess, recent offer to give the Greek people an actual vote on the European bailout, which of course was immediately retracted, because apparently Sarkozy made a direct death threat against Papandreou. I don't know if you've heard of that or if you could confirm or deny that, but I thought that was an interesting tidbit of information from Daniel Estulin.
Well, first of all, that interview will be in tomorrow's International Forecaster. Danny sometimes backs off because he doesn't want to cut off his sources. And when he comes out and tells you that Mr. Papandreou and Mr. Sarkozy, both who are luminous, is told that if you don't retract that thing, you're going to have a hole in your head, he does it. Now, why did he do it? The strategy, from what I guess, is this. And, of course, this isn't something that's well-known. It's my guesstimate. He saw the whole thing going down the chute, Papandreou. And he decided, look, why don't we have this referendum and the people will vote against taking the money on the bailout, the second bailout. And what they'll do, they'll say, we don't want it. And then I can blame the people for rejecting it. And it'll get me off the hot seat. That was his thinking. Well, the rest of Europe was aghast. And you know, Semeras and Papandreou were roommates at Harvard. Most people don't know that. So they're buddies. This is the incestuousness of things that happen in smaller countries. You know, countries that have populations, say, of 100 million or less. Everybody knows each other, especially if you're well-educated and your family's got money and so on and so forth. And so the problem is that you can't allow that because they want to save the euro. Everything else means nothing. They got to save the euro. The Eurozone, the European Union, because they have to have their world government. That's why. So they don't matter what it costs, because the public's going to pay for it anyway. And don't forget, they believe, in their brazen and arrogant way, that they are the masters of the universe. They're smarter than anybody else. Of course, I got news for them, that's not true. But they like to think of themselves in that way, especially as they get richer and richer. You have to have lived with the rich to understand most of them are depraved. And that goes back to the time when I was a caddy starting at 9 years old. they are different than most people. So anyway, that was why he did what he did, I think. And of course, Sarkozy was the who's a Mossad agent, incidentally. He's used to that sort of rough riding. And he told him. I get that from another source, incidentally. And so what Danny says just backs up what I was told. And I get a lot of information out of Europe. We have a lot of subscribers there. And some people are very, very bright and very connected. And I've been carrying a lot of tapes, audio and video, in both French and German, because we have such a large audience in Europe. Some people have been aghast when they go and talk to people and say, well, how do you know that? And they say, well, I subscribe to the International Forecaster, and like the head of the Greek Orthodox Church, and several members of the Dutch Parliament told two reporters. And in fact, one of them mentioned me in his book, this latest, no, not his book, his article in Vanity Fair. I can't think of his name right now. This cold has got me stuffed up, so I'm not the sharpest this morning. But anyway, that's where they're at. Now, what they're going to do is work toward implementing the bailout with derivatives. And the German court says, no, you can't do that. They're going to do it anyway. You got to understand, these people don't care about anything. And in the process, they're building up. Once I think they've taken Syria, they will go after Iran. And, you know, you got to think back about Iran. Mohammad Mossadegh was thrown out of office in, I think it was 58.
1953.
53, okay. And I met a lot of Iranians in Geneva when I lived there during those days who had fled the country. And he was put out of office by the CIA, and the Shah was installed. He was no more royalty than somebody out of the dog pound. But he wasn't dumb. He was smart. And then when his time was ready to be fulfilled and there was another mission for America in England, they went ahead and got rid of him. And they brought in Mr. Khomeini. And that whole strain, and I'm sure Press TV is not going to like this, of people who have been in power since Khomeini came have all had back-alley connections with the intelligence agencies of the Western world. And so you say to yourself, well, is Ahmed, pronounce his name for me, please. Ahmadinejad?
Ah, yes, Ahmadinejad, yeah.
Is that, that's close enough, okay. And I'm good at Western languages, but not in Eastern languages. And so, anyway, you got to ask yourself, what side is this guy on? And he's played a great role. And if it's real, it's real. But is it real? We don't know. And the reason I question it is the line of ascension from Khomeini upward. So you got to think about that. You know, these people who are behind the scenes pulling all these strings, they created all these wars in the past. They're really good at it. And they capture the people on both sides and say, look, this is what we're going to do. We got to get rid of population. And we got a depression on over here. We got to distract the people. So let's have World War II. That's really why it happened. And of course, the insiders made gugobs of money, and even the people who were the bad people, really, particularly the Japanese, who stole everything in Asia they could get their hands on, they got to keep half of it. And the CIA, which was the OSS at the time, got to keep the other half. But this is the way this stuff works. And jerks like me go off and work for the U.S. military or the U.S. government in any capacity fighting this dreadful enemy, whoever it may be. Well, the whole thing is a scam. And I think people are starting to find that out.
I think so. And I think you're very, very right in pointing out the at least the possibility that Ahmadinejad is not who he appears to be. And I think certainly it seems that the pieces are being lined up for an Iranian attack very soon. And on that very note, and speaking of Sarkozy l'Americain, as he's called in France, but Sarkozy le Mossad agent, as we've just identified, a very interesting story just came out via Reuters. Sarkozy tells Obama Netanyahu is a liar. And it says French President Nicolas Sarkozy branded Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a liar in a private conversation with U.S. President Barack Obama that was accidentally broadcast to journalists during last week's G20 summit in Cannes. "I cannot bear Netanyahu. He's a liar," Sarkozy told Obama, unaware that the microphone in their meeting room had been switched on, enabling reporters in a separate location to listen in to a simultaneous translation. "You're fed up with him, but I have to deal with him even more often than you," Obama replied, according to the French interpreter, which I think is particularly telling in a lot of ways. Any comments on that story?
Well, I can well believe that Netanyahu is an asset of the Central Intelligence Agency. And, of course, so is Sarkozy. And this might be an internal thing more than anything else. They've just had a big shakeup in Israel, and many of the people who were against invading Iran now want to do that. I didn't get into the basics as to why. The information came out yesterday, and I don't have time to read everything. And so I can't speak to what's going on behind the scenes, but it sounds like fratricidal interfighting among the Illuminists. I don't like him because he never shaves and he stinks. You know, that sort of thing. And Sarkozy saying he's a liar. Well, of course he's a liar, and so aren't you. Are there many politicians in this world historically who have not been liars? Not many.
No, and it seems that their ability is really gauged on how well they can lie. So, unfortunately, we get people like Bill Clinton. Yeah. At any rate, well, there you go. There's the G20 and the Euro crisis. But perhaps we should move along to other matters, because there are still, of course, really huge stories that are breaking in completely different sectors, including the very interesting story of John Corzine and MF Global. Perhaps you can get into that for us.
Well, I wrote about it for tomorrow's issue, and what is obvious is that John Corzine has a great deal of money. He bought elections as senator and then as a governor in New Jersey, did a dreadful job. Now, this is a man who is from Wall Street and banking, a bond trader, somebody who really understands what's going on. I mean, how do you screw a state up that bad when you're supposed to be super smart? And then he had that dreadful affair with that woman who ran a labor union, which ruined his marriage. So it shows that he doesn't have much morality. Then you switch back. Incidentally, it cost him $60 million to become senator in New Jersey, so he obviously made a great deal of money on Wall Street. And then, out of character, he took up what used to be Man Financial, and that was a conglomeration of other financials that had gone out of business. Big company, maybe the biggest clearing company in the commodities and forex markets. And a man who does bonds, now historically, since 1975, was the joint CEO of Goldman Sachs, which tells us he can't be dumb, he goes long the bonds of the nations in Europe that are in trouble. And, of course, they all went down in value. He was leveraged probably 200-300%. And he destroyed the company. His capital is wiped out, and the other sides of all their trades are going to be canceled. all kinds of brokerage firms are going to be left, and clients, whether they're institutional or individual, are going to be left holding the bag. And then there is the matter of a missing amount of money. Now, J.P. Morgan Chase, which acted in a part clearing capacity for MF Global, as it's called, they said they had the money that was missing, some $683 million. And then they said, no, we made a mistake, we don't have it. Now, wait a minute. J.P. Morgan Chase is probably the most powerful bank in the world. And Goldman might be the second most powerful. And they don't make those kind of mistakes. These people are very smart. And something has gone wrong. And so what's missing? Well, they're trying to hide it from the public is what they're trying to do. I think we're talking, I'm guessing now, from all the reports I've heard, maybe $120 billion. That's a lot of money. That's how much money Mr. Corzine lost in the markets, besides all the other market money that was up front for the company. Now, you've got to say to yourself, why does a man with such experience do what he did? And when he was asked about it by fellow employees, other officers, I assume, he said, look, I know all about politics and I know how this works. He just let me do what I want to do. And he did. And he destroyed the company. So the question comes up, and I'm always looking at the other side of the equation. Was this done deliberately? And you've got to say to yourself, if it was, why? Well, maybe it's because they want to start taking some of these markets down, they being the people who control things from behind the scenes. No, that's just a guess. And maybe that will prove out. Maybe it won't. Maybe it was straight stupidity that Mr. Corzine engaged in, but I don't think so. And so I don't think we've heard anywhere near 25% of what went on at MF Global. And it's going to have far-reaching effects, not on the order of Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. They were, I think, much, much larger. But it's not good. And was it real or was it a setup? We'll find out. But these are the things you got to ask yourself, because these people are so devious that the average person cannot contemplate in his mind that people can be so diabolically evil. So you keep that in mind when you look at things, because there are people out there who are that evil, believe me.
Well, I fear that you're not only right that this MF Global scandal is bigger than we can imagine, I fear that it will be bigger than we'll ever know, because unfortunately, The Guardian is reporting now that Gary Gensler, head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, is leading the inquiry into how hundreds of millions vanished last week from client accounts at MF Global. He built close ties to Corzine and eventually worked for him as they rose through the ranks of Goldman Sachs. Later, they collaborated on Capitol Hill to pass an anti-corporate fraud law. So we have an absolute clear-cut case of the fox guarding the henhouse here, and Gary Gensler is going to get to the bottom of this, supposedly. So your take on the investigation into this?
Well, first of all, I reported that on Saturday in my issue, and I know lots about Gensler. And he's another one of these Netanyahu, Sarkozy, Merkel, Papandreou, Cameron, whatever, one of these quasi-bureaucratic criminal types. You know, we're dealing with a criminal syndicate. And if you can understand that, and you can understand how the criminal mind works, then you can understand what these people are up to. So it's very important that you keep that in mind. We can go one step further with Gensler. He has had an investigation going on he inherited. He hasn't been there 3 years, but the investigation was the manipulation of the silver market. And they have a committee there at the CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, a regulatory body of the U.S. government that was set up, like the SEC, to protect Wall Street and screw the public. And remember that. I did that for almost 30 years. Worked in that industry, owned my own firm. So, Gensler deliberately held this investigation on silver manipulation up for 3 years, or 2.5 years, or whatever it was. Maybe it was as long as four. And there's one person on the group that's on the committee, Bart Shilton, and he's an appointee, like they all are. And he says the markets are being manipulated, but they won't listen to him because they get them outvoted. And Gensler was an instrument of JPM, that's JP Morgan Chase. He delayed that investigation all that time because Morgan was naked short, along with Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation, HSBC, about 65,000 naked short silver contracts. And as this commission finally ended, it's not ended, but at least came out with their statement, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, a month ago, whatever it was, they allowed Morgan to knock the silver market down and cover all but, well, there's only 15,000 net naked contracts right now from 65,000. So they extricated themselves. They probably lost a lot of money doing it. But it's my feeling, and I can't prove this, that Morgan's losses are guaranteed by the Federal Reserve so that the public can pay for it. See, the profits from the Federal Reserve go to the federal government. And so if they lose money that they would have given to the Treasury, then it only is taken out of the taxpayers' pockets. This is the way they look at it. And it's that's real, the real life. So anyway, Morgan got almost totally off the hook. And so did HSBC and GS, which is Goldman Sachs, and Citi. And they were all involved, Deutsche Bank. And they're the people who own the Federal Reserve, incidentally. There's others, but they're the main owners. And so Gensler is up to this caper, up to his eyeballs. And Shilton is driving him crazy. He says, no, you can't do that. That's not true. And they get gobs of evidence, external and internal. And they won't adjudicate against Morgan because Morgan owns them. I mean, this is how incestuous this whole thing is. It is incredible. And you don't hear a hue and cry from the public because they don't understand all this. And they can't be expected to do so. I mean, what is 25 or 30% of the people go to university? And even most of them don't know what's going on in relation to this. And so very few people find out what's going on. But that's what's going on. And Gensler, to use a colloquial term, is another scumbag, just like Corzine. And that's what's going on.
Well, don't pull your punches, Bob. Tell us what you really feel. No, but on the note of Morgan and this Commodity Futures Trading Commission and silver manipulation, people might remember that early last year, the head of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, Bill Murphy, came out and testified to the CFTC that there was a London-based metals trader, Andrew Maguire, who was blowing the whistle on silver manipulation by JP Morgan and who had actually predicted certain manipulations that JP Morgan was going to do that then actually took place. And that story, there was an update in March in which I guess Andrew McGuire had been hit in a London hit and run, and there was a lot of kerfuffle about that. I don't know if you've ever, have you ever heard of any updates to that story?
Oh, I covered it very deeply. I know Bill Murphy quite well. I don't know Mr. McGuire. And what happened was that the testimony that the CFTC would not allow McGuire to give at their hearing in March, which is by invitation only, he couldn't give the testimony. So two other people, Bill Murphy and another gentleman, from London, they gave the testimony in behalf of him, and CFTC went berserk. And right after that, yes, someone tried to kill the McGuires. And so these people play hardball. And I keep on telling these newsletter writers, you know, if you're going to report that kind of stuff, you got to be prepared to pay the price, because these people kill people. And that's why most of them won't come out with the whole truth, because they're afraid they'll get knocked off.
Well, that is a pretty blunt assessment and pretty sobering, but it does, I think, give to the audience a bit of an impression of just what people like yourself go through in bringing this information to people and calling people out for what they are. And it's not just something that you're doing for fun. I mean, this is something where you really do put your life on the line, and that's why you don't even live in America anymore. So it's a very serious thing, and I hope people do appreciate it. And I imagine by this point, people who have been listening to our conversations for any length of time do appreciate your analysis. So I certainly hope they have checked out the International Forecaster, but for those who haven't yet done so, let's go over what the Forecaster is and how people can get a copy.
Well, now that you've mentioned that, I guess I'm a vagabond of the third world. And with that said, the International Forecaster is about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues all over the world, published by email on Wednesdays and Saturdays, runs around 35 or 40 pages each time. We have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those of you who are not on the internet. You can get a free introductory copy by going to theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, forecaster.com, or you can go to www.intforecaster.com, intforecaster.com. For those of you who would like to ask a question, we answer everyone, and or get either of the reports, or get a report on our latest recommendation in gold and silver shares, you can email us, and that address is Bob, B-O-B, at intforecaster.com, Bob at intforecaster.com. And for those of you who would like to call toll-free, that phone number is 877-479-8178, 877-479-8178, and you can pick up a copy of either there, or if you'd like to become a subscriber, they have an offer there of a free one-year subscription, and the offer that they're making is really terrific, and you should take advantage of it.
I hope people do, because as exciting as our conversations are, it only comes once a week, and yet the newsletter comes twice a week, so people can get their hands on the Forecaster twice a week. So I hope they're taking advantage of that and all of the incredible services that you offer people in responding to everyone's emails. I know that can be an incredible challenge. So again, my hat's off to you for your boundless energy, and I really do look forward to our conversation every week, so I promise I won't forget it next week. But it is, having said that, I'm very much looking forward to next Monday.
Well, thank you very much, and I'd like to thank you all for listening, and I really enjoy doing this show.